Read Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach is a good opportunity to discuss the question of the death penalty in Halacha. And just to clarify, what I'd like to talk about today is not so much Misas Bezdin. We'll use Misas Bezdin as a little bit of a background, a little bit of perspective, but what we're interested in focusing on today is the question of how do we view the death penalty in America? That if we as American citizens who are educated in Jewish tradition and Jewish sources are asked what's the Jewish impression, what's the Jewish perspective on the death penalty, so what would we say? So just to begin with, so what would you say? If somebody were to stop you on the street, let's say a non-Jewish politician were to say, okay, you're a yeshiva student, I value your opinion and the tradition that you represent, I have to vote in the government, the legislature, whatever. Happens to be it's largely a state issue for the most part in America. Let's say it's a state legislature I have to vote in. So tell me, what should I say? Share your wisdom with me about the death penalty. Shaul, what would you say?
So I would say that definitely, obviously the Torah believes in there being an official death penalty on the book, so to speak. But later the Gemara talks about how a Beis Din that killed one person every 7 years was called a murder on Beis Din. So clearly, Halacha, the way we practiced, it was definitely anti it for practical or technical reasons, even though it believed fundamentally that such a concept should exist.
Okay, so that's actually the perfect answer. What I mean.
But of course, I would tell them that I don't know that necessarily that Jewish law should shape secular policy. That's the class discussion.
Right. So that's actually that could fit better. So this is also a good synergy to get those different elements in. But what I mean by the perfect answer, and that I think that's the answer most people would give. Most people with exposure to Jewish sources would tend in that direction, and it may or may not be correct. And our intention today is not necessarily to take a stand on whether that's exactly the right approach, but to highlight some of the complexities in getting to that approach. I think one might come with that answer, but it's not so direct dependent. Yeah, so basically what Shaul said, which again I think is the answer many, many people would give to this question, it's not to disparage it in any way, but that, well, if we look at Jewish sources, so what do we find? We find that undeniably there is a concept of the Chi of Misa. There is a notion that we find that the Chi Torah prescribes Misa for many Averos. So that makes it hard to say that we don't believe in the death penalty at all. But on the other hand, we also are familiar with sources that both directly and indirectly convey the impression that it was very, very rarely applied. Some convey it directly. As Shaul mentioned, you have the Mishnah that quotes one opinion that says that a Sanhedrin that executed every 7 years, then every 70 years, is considered to be a bloody Beis Din. It's not the only opinion, but it's an opinion. And we also know, we'll talk about the details, that it's very difficult to get executed in a Sanhedrin, and therefore that's the indirect way of conveying that it's unlikely it happened too often. And you put all that together, so how do you resolve that tension? So it seems like we want the death penalty to be on the books, and at the same time we want it to be applied very, very, very rarely, if at all. So it's a way of conveying a certain message about the value system, while not necessarily manifesting itself in actual executions. And I guess we had this experience a little bit last week. We commented on how many of the guys preparing the Marmokomos said they felt that they are definitely discouraged from doing any Avera for which you're a Chayav Malkus, that the experience of just considering the concept and being aware that the Torah assigns a certain punishment, even theoretically, to a given Avera is enough to instill a feeling about it, and maybe that's the idea. The Torah wants this death penalty to be on the books, but doesn't want it actually to be invoked. So that's, again, it's a very logical approach. It's an approach that may be correct, but what I want to highlight today for a little bit is that it's a complicated path to get there. Because, first of all, I'll mention that not only does the Torah in many places tell us about executing people, But it does so very prominently in yesterday's Kriyas HaTorah in Parshas Noah, where we are told that at least for murder, that seems to be the appropriate consequence. Right? Shofech dam ha'adam, v'dam ba'adam dam v'yishofech, that somebody who spills the blood of another person, his own blood should be spilled. And it's particularly noteworthy that this is a pasuk in Parshas Noah addressed to humanity as a whole. And in the current debate about the death penalty, let's say in America, that's where you're most likely to have the discussion, right? Should America be executing murderers? Now, it happens to also be a particularly current and painfully so issue in Israeli society also. Should Israel take a different policy towards executing murderers? A fair question also. But all of these questions, the truth is, come from different vantage points. Because any source that you're going to quote that's going to address, let's say, a chiyuv misa, it's going to address the death penalty, is going to come from at least three different contexts. And in order to address the issue accurately, we have to identify what these different contexts are, and we have to consider whether or not we're applying things accurately. So the first context is really the subject of our Masechta as a whole, and that is the Sanhedrin. That is the formalized Beis Din Sanhedrin with all of the details in place under all the proper protocols. That's one context in which it comes up. A second context in which it could come up, and I'll explain a little bit more, is a Jewish government, the Jewish Beis Din, functioning in an extra legal capacity, functioning outside the protocols of the Sanhedrin. And that also has its own rules and regulations. And then a third context, which really on the surface is the most relevant to the question of the death penalty in America, is the corpus of Dinei Bnei Noach, which is a localized topic in Maseches Sanhedrin. The Gemaras about it are also in Maseches Sanhedrin, but the first topic, we said, was the topic of our whole Masechta, and the third one is the topic of part of our Masechta. But our Limud this year of Sanhedrin is relevant to all three of these dimensions, but it's important to note that they are distinct dimensions. So
what's the third one?
The third one is Dinei Bnei Noach, which on the surface is the most relevant, right? What is governing American law in the Jewish perspective, from the halachic perspective? Presumably it is Dinei Bnei Noach, which the Torah recognizes, endorses, and commands. So to try to answer that question, when your friend in the legislature asks you, tell me, what does Judaism have to say about the death penalty? So how do you properly address this question, considering the fact that there are these different perspectives? So let's try to look a little bit at what these perspectives tell us. So first of all, so let's talk about one by one. So the Sanhedrin. So we know that it's clearly the case that the Torah does place on the books a chiyuv misa for many different daveros. And we spoke a little bit last week, during the week, about how Malchus fits into that, how it compares to that, what it has in common, and what it doesn't have in common. And we made reference to the fact that the notion of Misas Beis Din as a mitzvah is the topic of a Machlokas Rishonim in terms of how to count, which sounds on the surface like a boring Machlokas, like it doesn't really matter very much. Count however you want, doesn't really make a difference. But I think it has philosophical ramifications and conceptual ramifications. So the three positions we alluded to last week were, on the one hand, what were the three positions? There was the Ramban, right? What is the Ramban's view? It's all one mitzvah. U'bi'arto haram mikirdecha. You have the view of the Rambam. What was the Rambam's position? Four mitzvos. Skilas reifa harib chanik. You had a chance this morning, you saw the four references to Sefer HaMitzvos, Reish Chav Vav to Reish Chav Tes. And then you have the Bahag. What does the Bahag maintain? Every Chiyuv Misa is separate. So, what are the philosophical implications of this Machlokas? So, we alluded to it a little bit last week, just very specifically with the Rambam. So let's try to take all three together, and I'll give you a mashal. Okay, let's say, as a teacher, let's say I had a student who was talking in class, so I threw him out of class. For the record, I've never actually done this, but let's assume that that happened for the sake of this discussion. So, why did I throw this kid out of class? What's the reason? Why did I have to do that? So I think there are, let's say, three reasons why I might do that. One reason is that I can't teach if he's sitting here talking in the back, distracting everyone, being loud, making everyone not pay attention. It's very hard for me to have a productive classroom experience. So in order to protect the rest of the class, I throw him out. So he's not going to learn outside, but at least the rest of the class will be able to learn once he has been separated from them. So that's reason one, what we'll call the good of society. The good of the class, in this case, the good of society. Reason two might be different. It might be, I'm not really worried about the class. I'm more interesting than this guy is. They'll listen to me, they're not going to listen to him. So it's not really a problem for me to teach. But I'm worried about him. That if he thinks he can break such an obvious rule, and he can sit here in class talking with impunity, so that'll just be the first step in a long life career of law-breaking and international terrorism. It will probably all flow from the fact that he was able to talk in class without any objection from the teacher. So right now, I am going to save him and all of his victims, and I'm saying, get out now, learn your lesson, and change your ways. So that is a different reason to take punitive action. That is for the good of the criminal. Right here in this case, the offender, the criminal, is the talking student. I'm worried about him. He should not think this is okay. He should change his ways. So for his own good, I take this punitive action. A third reason I might do it, let's say I'm not worried about the class. I'm more interesting than he is. I'm not worried about him. I'm a substitute teacher. I don't care what happens. But I'm worried about the law. If it says on the wall, no talking in class, and this student can just sit there and talk and nothing happens, so then that law doesn't mean anything. It's empty. If I want the law to be meaningful, it has to be shown that it has bite, that it's backed up, and therefore in order to support the very concept of the law, I'm going to have to take action. So those three perspectives, we could call them the good of society, the good of the criminal, the offender, and the good of the law. Sammy?
Why is that third reason distinct from the first two? Because you have the law in the first place because of one of those first reasons, either for the good of the kid or for the good of the classroom.
Yeah, it's true, but it's much more conceptual than I think. The first one is more practical, that right now society is at risk because of this specific behavior. So you want to save them from this behavior. Let's say if we're talking about a murderer, so he's running around killing people. So we need to save them from being killed by this guy, so we're removing him from society. In this case, it's more conceptual that we want all our laws to be meaningful. We don't want our laws to be empty. Shaoli mentioned the business class, which we're doing also, so we know that last week made reference to the fact that it's unfortunate when society has unenforced laws because that erodes the respect that people have for the law. We don't really want to have unenforced laws. We want to have laws that are meaningful, and therefore that will have an effect on the entire law-abiding character of the population. So to have laws that are not upheld, so if they're not upheld because they shouldn't be upheld, so better they should be taken off the books completely. But if there are meaningful laws and they're not upheld, then they lose their bite, and that undermines the whole system. So it's more conceptual than the first one. We're talking about an actual damage. In the second case, we're worried about how this person is really, second is really much more distinct, that we just don't want this individual to lose his way and to believe that he can escape all kinds of consequences. So it's much more focused on him than it is on the concept of the law as a whole. Now, of course, they're all related concepts, but I think that's enough to distinguish them. Yeah.
I would say another way to label this last one is to help conceptualize the division would be to say it's the good of other criminals almost. Because it's by showing blood bite.
Okay, well, you'll have a deterrence effect.
That's a part, I guess. Of
right, which is also true. You know, sometimes I make these distinctions, people ask, well, what about deterrence? That's one of the major themes we hear referred to in theory of punishment. So the truth is all of these connect to deterrence and connect to other issues. So yes, that's definitely true also. So if we take these three perspectives, so we could suggest that you have a machlokas rishonim here as to what is the purpose of misat gezeira. Why do you have punishments? Why do you have punishments such as execution? That essentially, the Ramban seems to believe that the main purpose of misas bez din is to protect society. Whether it protects society from physical harm, because people are going around doing dangerous things, or to protect them from spiritual harm, because people are going around causing a bad influence. But whatever it is to protect society from the harmful presence of these individuals. So all of that is accomplished in various ways, but it's all one goal. Ubiyarta haram yikirbah. It seems like that is consistent with the protecting society idea.
For a sheep.
Right. While the Rambam, this we explained a little bit last week, right, that the Rambam seems to be the least logical of the three choices, with all due respect. Right? That idea to distinguish specifically between different types of Misa, different methodologies of Misa, so who cares? Why would that be considered so different that that should be the way to count? It seems like it's more logical to either say like the Ramban, it's all one idea, and it's the detail as to what kind of Misa you're using. Or to say like the Bahag, that each tree of Misa deserves its own discussion. But to differentiate specifically by methodology is not immediately obvious why you should do that. So the main issue at play in methodology is the assumption that one is more severe than the other. These four mises, machlokas, exactly how I rank them, but that they are ranked with different degrees of severity. And therefore, the assumption is that every chiyuv misa correlates to a varying need for kapara. Somebody who sinned a level A sin requires a level A kapara. Someone who sinned a level B sin requires level B kapara. Whatever it is, it's going to vary based on the degree of atonement that is necessary. So if that's our focus, right, so the Rambam's focus is on who here? It's on the sinner, right? It's on the offender. How much of a kapara does he need? It doesn't really focus on his victims or on society or on the law itself, but just on providing the adequate degree of atonement. Now, to say something is for the good of the offender, it seems a little strange to say that when you're talking about the death penalty. How could the death penalty ever be for your own good? But from a religious perspective, it is possible to say that because we believe there is a world after this one, and one theoretically could benefit from a kapara, even if it is a fatal one. So the concept makes more sense than it would, let's say, in a modern-day secular context. So if you're to ask in America, why does America carry out punishment? You could have these various theories as well, but it would be hard to argue that the death penalty is there for the good of the offender. That's why in our model as a student, we used a less lethal example. But within the context of spiritual existence, where there's a world after this one, so it's a tenable interpretation, and perhaps that's what the Rambam understands. And within that understanding, last week we spoke about the Chiyuv Malchus, specifically within the Rambam's understanding, flow well from that, that Malchus he would understand essentially as another type of Misa, another way of imposing a kapara, and that becoming the default punishment as far as he understood it. So the Bahag, that would seem to correlate with the third perspective. The idea that we're trying to protect the law, so maybe that's what the Bahag is telling us. that every time there is an Aveira for which one would be Chayiv Misa, the Torah is saying, don't do this Aveira. And if somebody does this Aveira, back it up, enforce this principle by executing the Aveira. Yes, sir.
It seems that you could fit that into the first one also to protect society.
From a specific Aveira.
From a specific Aveira.
It's a little, I think it's a little harder to say that. I mean, I would just say that we should distinguish, if our goal is to protect society, do we have to differentiate between all the different categories? It would seem like it's easier to group it into one good concept than to say that we're protecting society from harmful influences. Now, I should emphasize that I think there are overlaps between these theories, and I think also that every theory would agree with the other one that the other goals exist. I think the Ramban certainly acknowledges that there's four Chilukei Misa and that there's different levels of kapara. And the Rambam certainly acknowledges the ideal of Ubiar Teharab Mikerbecha. And clearly they all acknowledge each other's values. And the question is just, what do we emphasize when we look at the whole goal of Chilukei Misa? What's our main point of emphasis? And then maybe it's possible to suggest that you have these three different points of focus. And that each one latches onto something else. And again, this happens to work well with what we discussed last week in the Rambam and Malchus. Okay, so within that, so those three angles could be considered within Misa's Bezdin. And you know, that could perhaps address various details that come up. Maybe we'll come back to this. We'll see to fill in a few more details. But some questions that come up in terms of how Misa's Bezdin is carried out may depend on, you saw Mar Makomus, Tosfos and Kulei, so various questions that could come up as far as whether one Misa could be traded for another, and things such as that, that could flow from the question of what exactly is the purpose of Misa's Bezdin. Now, within the context of Misa's Bezdin, so it's true that it's very difficult to get executed. That if we assume that in American society, to get exonerated, to get off, you need to hire a fancy lawyer. In the Sanhedrin system, you'd have to hire a fancy lawyer to get executed. And it's very, very hard to get executed. Because, what do you need? So you need to have two witnesses, see what you did. The two witnesses have to be kosher witnesses, which means they have to be adult, observant Jewish males who are not related to each other, not related to the defendant, etc., etc. And not only that, but they also, this is perhaps the hardest detail, they have to issue a hasra, and the hasra has to be accepted, which makes things very, very unlikely. Right? That basically, they have to warn the defendant in enough detail. It's a whole debate how much detail. So, for example, in Hilchos Shabbos, there is a discussion of the Rishonim. Does one have to identify the specific malacha that's being involved? How much detail they have to go into is subject to discussion. But we know that there has to be a hasra. And the hasra is a challenging requirement because, first of all, the recipient has to accept it, which is very unlikely, right? If you're trying to not get executed, so you'd be unlikely to want to accept it. There is a discussion what this is about. I think I mentioned, or I will mention in the business class, of those who are taking the semester, that one of the theories of law and the whole way in which a society is legislated is that the members of society get together and they aggregate their rights. They say, okay, we each have the rights that we possess, so to speak, and if we get together as a group, we can decide that the collective can legislate and can regulate us, and we'll agree to do that in order to have a function in society. So there was an Italian philosopher in the 1700s who was very influential on the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers of this country, a lot of them were opposed to the death penalty. I mentioned last week this was a raging debate even before 1776, the days of the colonies. This was a major debate. This has gone on in America for good, say, 400 years. The question of, again, before the country actually existed, of whether there should be a death penalty. And there were many death penalty abolitionists among the Founding Fathers, so a number of them were influenced by this Italian philosopher, whose name was Cesare Beccaria, who maintained that the death penalty is inherently immoral because you can't have an agreement to kill people, that society only is justified in making any legislation because everyone has given this right to its leadership, and nobody would ever hand over the right to others to kill them. So therefore, it doesn't exist the idea that there can be a legitimate death penalty. And other very prominent philosophers argued on this, and they said that that's not what it means. The idea of aggregating your rights doesn't mean like you're given a checklist and you say, okay, here's what you can do. You can tow my car, and you can give me a ticket, and you can put me in jail, and you can give me a fine, but I don't check off the box that you can execute me. It's not how it works. It means that we acknowledge the legitimacy of the central authority in deciding what it has to do in order to keep society functioning, and theoretically, that could include execution also. No specific punishment is identified or could be identified because nobody would give over the right to anyone else to do anything bad to them, to put them in jail either. So that's not what we're assuming. We're assuming that giving over your rights means you acknowledge the legitimacy of the central authority, and therefore punishments can logically flow from that. So if that's the case, you could have a chi of miso also. And there were those who wrote about 50 years ago, 60 years ago, when there was a debate about this in Israeli society, as we'll come to in a few minutes. So there were those who maintained that it, what the concept means, by Reines or an article about this, so that the idea is that in Mekabel the Hasra, we call Yakter Atzmo Lemisa, means that you are acknowledging the authority of the Sanhedrin. In this case, that they have the right to take the action that they need to take. Now, another of the striking halachos of Beis Din and of Mises Beis Din is that the hasra expires. And how long it takes the hasra to expire? Toch de dibor. That is a very short period of time. It just elapsed from the time I just said it, right? The maximum of Tokrei Dibor is 9 seconds. It could be 2 seconds, 3 seconds, a very short period of time. So why should it expire? What's the issue? So it sounds like from Rashi and Ksubis that the concern is that we're afraid that you may forget, that the defendant may forget the Hasra. I think when we talked about the during a Sarah Shemichu, we had that Bakias Sanhedrin share, those who were there, we talked about this a little bit. So that's also very hard to believe. Right? So somebody's about to kill somebody else, and two witnesses come and say, you know, if you do this, you'd be high meis. And he says, yes, I know, thank you for telling me. And then 30 seconds later, he does it. And says, oh, we just told you. 30 seconds ago, I think I remember. So it's a little hard to understand. This is something that Kisel Sachoshen and Simon Chavches struggled with. You know, how could it be that we really think that after Tochid Edibor, the person is going to forget about it? So this was a point that Rav Soloveitchik addressed. And so far as I understand, his language was as follows, that the idea of Hasra, so, and this again is something we talked about in more length than that year, it's a little bit of a different topic, maybe we'll come back to it. But the idea of Hasra, so Gemara has a whole discussion what Hasra is meant to accomplish. So the Gemara suggests, at least according to one opinion, that lo nitna Hasra ela lahavchin ben shogeg lemezid, that the purpose of Hasra is so that we can distinguish between those who are intentional and those who are not intentional, those who are sinning on purpose and those who are not sinning on purpose. So you might say, okay, so if we know that it's intentional, that's all we need. So the Gemara has an opinion that therefore chaver eino tzarech hasra, if a person is a talmid chacham, so then there's no need to issue hasra because we know that he's aware. And one might come to other conclusions, and one should then think that also it's hard to imagine why something should elapse after just a few seconds. That should be enough, a minute to 2 minutes, even 5 minutes should be enough to guarantee that the person knows what's going on. So as Rav Soloveitchik understood it, the purpose of Hasra, we talk about mezid. Mezid doesn't just mean what we think it means, that you know that it's wrong. Mezid means something much more than that. That mezid means that we have to ascertain through Hasra, I think his language was, ad heichan hu poregol. Just to what degree, to what level, has this person completely thrown off all authority and all civility, that not only is he willing to sin, but he's willing to sin in such a blatant fashion that when it's actively in his consciousness, it's in the forefront of his mind, not just if he asked the question, he could retrieve the information, but that he's thinking about it right now, the fact that this is a rebellion against God, and it's being witnessed, and it's been brought to the forefront of his consciousness, and he's willing to do it like that, so that's the kind of person who's chayiv misa. But anybody less than that is not chayiv misa. And that's, again, how some of the rabbinic philosophers who considered the question of chayiv misa, they understood it like that, that the reason you have a standard like this is because the only time a chiyuv misa like this is appropriate is when somebody has reached such a degree of incorrigibility where you assume there's really no hope for this guy because he's so far gone that he's willing to sin under that specific set of circumstances. That's when you have a chiyuv misa.
So what he's arguing is that after Tov Tedib, where it's not, he's not necessarily part of all, so to speak, he's more just doing it for like his own personal like reason.
Well, basically, the point is, you do it the other way around. That the point of the Hasra is not that he should have this fact in his library somewhere, that he should know. If you were to ask him a few months later, do you know this is prohibited? Yeah, somebody told me that once, now that you mention it. It's that you want to see that even when this is in his active consciousness, this is what he's thinking about right now. Not just that he knows it, but that he's thinking about it right now. And he's still willing to do this. It means he's doing it out of a sense of pure rebellion.
Okay, so like after 3 seconds, the assumption is that it's
he's
not
thinking about something. Right, okay. He's thinking about something else right now. So yes, he knows. Right, so you can't credibly say, "Oh, I had no idea that this was prohibited." Of course, he knows it's prohibited. The question is, was he focused on that prohibition and its consequences, and the awareness and witnesses? So that's a level of chutzpah that obviously we can't come back from. But short of that, maybe not. Now we have other halachas that are also very striking, and maybe we'll have a chance to discuss them within the context of their sugyas in Sanhedrin, so I'll just allude to them. But just to mention two of the particularly unusual halachas, which just highlight just how difficult it is to get executed. So again, we said that the message that Mises Bezdin is very rare is conveyed both directly and indirectly in our halakhic codes, and now I'm giving you more examples of how it's indirectly conveyed. Just the details are so tricky that you can see why it's difficult. So other details that make this point, for example, we know that, well, we don't know, but there is a difference in structure, first of all, just to highlight this, a difference in structure between, say, American law and the Sanhedrin. Then the American legal system, so you have an adversarial system, you have ideally representatives of, on the one hand, the prosecuting authority, a prosecutor who's a lawyer representing the government, and the defendant also has a lawyer who's there to defend him. Those are two different people. And then you have a judge who's really there in an officiating, observational role, presiding over everything. A lot of times he's not actually performing as much of an active role as others are. And the jury is really the one who's going to decide the facts, decide guilt or innocence, and in some cases will decide the penalty also. Sometimes the judge decides that. And so that's the basic structure within American law. Now in the Sanhedrin, it's very different. In the Sanhedrin, so the judges are judge, jury, and defense attorney. Right? It's really their job to evaluate the facts and to decide what the story is, decide guilt or innocence and punishment. And they also have to be the defense attorney, meaning they also have to decide, they also have to be able to advocate on behalf of the defendant. They have to have people among them who are saying that, well, what about this, what about that? And they have to be able to consider all the possible arguments for innocence.
The Sanhedrin plays all three roles.
Right. Essentially, the judges are playing, they're the jury, they are the judges as much as anyone else. They are the jury too, because they're the ones who are going to vote on guilt or innocence. And they're also, it's their responsibility to make sure to defend the defendant. While the witnesses are there both as witnesses and sometimes as prosecutors, because it's their job also to make the case that the crime has taken place. So those are very different roles than we find, let's say, in our contemporary American system. So the idea that the Sanhedrin is there to serve as a defending force is a little bit surprising, and it's emphasized by a few halachos which are also somewhat surprising. So one of them is we have a whole sugya that appears a few places in Shas about in aid nisa dayan, the question of whether somebody who has witnessed a event and that individual later serve as a dayan regarding that same event. So one of the issues that we find, which seems a little bit funny when you think about it, is that if you have, let's say, a person who witnessed the murder, so then he can't be a dayan on this capital case. So why not? What's the problem? So the problem is that his job as a dayan is that he has to be able to argue for the defense of the defendant. And we're worried that if he witnessed the crime, it's going to be never harder for him to argue in the defense. So it's a funny idea. You think, okay, so here we've even more firmly established that the guilt is there, but our focus is more on preserving the dying's ability to play this role of defense, and that's going to be compromised because his partiality has been taken away because he actually witnessed the crime happening. So therefore, he can't be a dying. So that's one of the striking halachas. The other one, which is also worth discussing in more length, and we'll come back to, is a very unusual halacha that, again, to compare to the American system. So usually you need a unanimous jury. So you have 12 citizens who are going to consider the case, and they have to argue amongst themselves and ultimately come to a unanimous decision. And if they don't, then you have a hung jury, you have a problem with the jury that can't decide, and then that could be a mistrial, or we'll have to do it again, or we'll have to keep waiting until they keep arguing back and forth until they can come to a decision. So that unanimity, okay, we could understand, especially a capital case, so you want everyone to be sure before executing someone. But in the Sanhedrin, so we have a very counterintuitive concept that the din is Sanhedrin Shiro Kula L'chova. So if the whole Sanhedrin is unanimous that this person is guilty, so then you let him go. That's how most of the Rishonim understand. The Meiri admittedly understands it a little bit differently. But that's the common understanding of that idea, that if the Sanhedrin is unanimous, then the defendant is exonerated, or is not executed. So that's hard to understand, unless, again, you could bring various perspectives to it. Some say that, you know, nothing can be so clear-cut. So if it really seems to everyone here that he's definitely guilty, that itself must be a symbol that he's not guilty. Everything that's real in life is a little more complicated, so if there's nobody who doesn't see it in the same way, then already that's a simon we should explore a little bit further. But others explain it, that if we said before, that the Dayanim of the Sanhedrin have an obligation to also be defense attorneys, so it seems like there's no one defending this guy. It seems that if the entire Sanhedrin is convinced that he's guilty, so then he's missing his basically entitled defense and something that's deficient as far as the process is concerned. So these two very striking halachos reflect a core difference in the whole structure of the Sanhedrin versus the secular law, but it also highlights the fact that highlights the fact that there's a very different structure that exists as far as the Sanhedrin is concerned. Sam, you had a question?
Yeah, so if the entire if the entire Sanhedrin decides that he's innocent, that's also you would have to say he's clear cut, no? Like
the bias is always towards innocence. So, therefore,
but the
star
would still apply.
Right, except that then we're basically stuck with that hachra if you want to apply that svar. But then the benefit of the bias is always going to be, the benefit of the doubt is always towards innocence. That's what we find in the structure. So, we can handle it not being parallel as far as that's concerned, that we end up letting the guy go. Hi.
There's a similar mention in some Sanhedrin, I think, that if someone decides that, if one of the people, Sanhedrin decides that the person is innocent and wants to change their mind, they can no longer change their mind. But if they decided they was guilty and wanted to change
innocent, right. Yeah, no, we find throughout Sanhedrin that there's a bias on behalf of defending the individual. We find it already from this Mishnah, but you find throughout, right, definitely in the later Mishnah, later Brachim, that it's clear that there's this bias that any possible side of innocence, we want to let that come out, while we don't necessarily go in the other direction. It's not parallel. Forces of defense and the forces of guilt do not exactly match each other. So these differences, on the one hand, highlight just a different structure as far as the Sanhedrin and secular court systems are concerned, but in addition to that, they also call attention to the complexity of the challenge of getting executed in a Sanhedrin. It's just apparently not so likely. There's a lot of forces that are working against your getting executed, and therefore it seems that it is indeed the case that it would be a very rare scenario for an execution actually to be carried out. So if this was our only perspective, if this area was the only area we had to look at, so then indeed I think the opening statement that we had, the question of what does Jewish law say about the death penalty, so yeah, you'd have to say, you're right, that that's the case, that Jewish law does have it on the books, but is very, very hesitant to actually impose it. However, as we indicated, there are at least two other categories, and we're not going to have time before Melchizedek to discuss them both. We'll probably have a two-parter, we'll continue this into next Sunday, but let's at least start the second category. So the second category addresses a very basic question, which bothers a lot of people when they hear these details. And you hear everything that we just said, so a lot of people have a mixed reaction. Because on the one hand, killing people seems harsh. We don't want people to die if they don't have to. So we are a little bit relieved to hear that Mises Besdin seems to be a very unlikely scenario, and very rarely, if ever, carried out. On the one hand, that relieves us. On the other hand, we're not totally relieved, because we also know that there are some people who do deserve to be executed, or at least stopped, and if it's so easy to slip through the Sanhedrin system, so what society can be protected? How are we going to have any defense against wanton criminals? It's very easy to do whatever crime you want, and just make sure that you don't have two ways. So this is an issue that Rishonim discussed already, Perhaps most prominently the Drasha Saran, where he has a famous Drasha, Drasha Aleph, where he talks about this. And he addresses the fact that there really is a two-tiered system. That we have the system we just described, which is very good for addressing the ritual offenses that are Hayav Misa, and the fully enforced protocol when all the details are in place the way it's normally addressed. But what about people who actually are a harm and a danger to society, let's say in the physical sense, or the spiritual sense in a way that's more extreme and that requires immediate attention? So the Gemara has a phrase, appears in a couple of places, Shamati Shebezdin Makin Va'onshin Shalom Benhadin. I heard that Bezdin can be Makkah, can give Malchus, and can give Onshin Shalom Benhadin. That's not Minhadin. And as the Gemara explains, it doesn't mean it's against the law, Shalom Avar al Debre Torah, not to violate the din, but in order to uphold the din. That apparently there is a extra legal system that if there is a functional danger to society, so society is also empowered to deal with it. Now that is primarily the role really of the king. So we call Mishpat HaMelech, as the Ran discusses in his Gasha. But it could be, there's a big topic in the Rishonim and others, that the Sanhedrin could also function in that capacity. The Sanhedrin could function in a dual capacity. They could be the ones carrying out the ritual law, and they could also serve as the functional physical protectors of society by acting in this Makan Va'omshin Shalom and Hadin track of doing the Mishpat HaMelech. That's it.
This could maybe turn into the Rambam Ramban locus. About the purpose of law in the first place.
Yes, it could. And that's something I want to discuss in the context of Bnei Noach, so we'll probably get to that next week. Sammy?
For this approach, I just mentioned that the Sanhedrin could do both. Mm-hmm. So, with the Gemara that says that a Sanhedrin that killed once in however many years is murderous, would that apply only to the first approach?
It seems it would be, yeah. That except it's interesting because there is the machlokas there in the Mishnah, which isn't often paid attention to, that the next opinion says if you're going to take that approach, then Rabu Shof Kedavim B'Yisroel. So then, you know, it sounds like the first opinion, unless they're kind of talking past each other, which is also possible, it sounds like the first opinion is actually talking about people who are murderers and who are dangerous, and still they're willing to be very restrained about it. So that essentially, I think, addresses your question, that on the surface, it seems more likely, based on the distinction that we're talking about, that this hesitancy is really in the context of the Mises Bezdin in the general sense of Hasra and that whole story, and that if somebody was actually running around killing people, we'd hope the Sanhedrin be a little bit more proactive. But then the question is, why does the next opinion say, Imkain Rabbi Shalpi Dam Bizrael? So then that's, are they talking about different cases? Are they talking about the same kind of case? It's a fair question to ask. Adir?
So for the Ran, it's specifically the Melech, we can do this extra...
But the Sanhedrin could also do it, but it's all under the headline. Presumably, we're showing to discuss exactly who can do it or not, but the question is, whose office is in charge here? That basically, this is about societal protection. This is not about enforcing ritual law. This is not about spreading God's message. This is about keeping society safe. Now, it could also extend to spiritual matters also, in that if somebody is a terrible influence on society and is creating a breakdown in discipline, so theoretically you might find also Sanhedrin has the authority to act outside the normal parameters. So there is this concept of extra legal steps that are there when, that are available when there is a pressing societal need. So this was discussed, I'll just mention this for a minute, and we'll have to continue this next week. But in the early 1950s, which is the early years of the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, so there was a discussion, should we bring back the death penalty? And as we noted, that discussion is really very current today also. Should the state of Israel impose the death penalty on murderers? So the chief rabbi and those associated with chief rabbis who were involved in this discussion in the early 1950s, for the most part, seems to have taken the position that the death penalty is not appropriate. because the assumption is that the modern state of Israel, we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have the system to impose category 1 Chiyuv Misa. So all we would be talking about is category 2 Chiyuv Misa. And category 2 is motivated by the desire to protect society. So the assumption, which deserves to be considered carefully, is that if you have a concept of life imprisonment, so then you don't run the risk of endangering society. You could lock people up forever, and they're not going to pose a harm to society, so maybe there's no legitimacy to killing them. Again, the topic hotly debated at the moment. So that was the policy that was adopted, that the Israeli government only executed, only has executed, and only executes as a matter of policy, Nazi war criminals, like Eichmann. But for the most part, regular run-of-the-mill criminals, including terrorists, don't get subjected to the death penalty because of an approach such as that. So this is... Whoever it is, they don't impose the death penalty outside of Nazi war criminals. And this is a topic that is constantly being debated.
See, based on what we just said, there's, according to, at least from a halakhic perspective, there's really no rationale to execute Nazi war criminals because I don't think that there's very much of a risk, so to speak, of a reoffending Nazi war criminal.
Right. So it seems that Nazis are treated as a whole different category. Why that is a fair question. That actually will come up soon. You privileged few in the business class. In the business class, that will actually come up in that context.
Is that the Amalek category?
No. It has to do with.
I
should
switch the sentence.
Yes, right. So sorry, I'm purposely discriminating against the rest of the class, and only you privileged few will hear about that. Possibly this week. If you're very lucky, maybe we'll revisit it here also. All right, so we're about out of time, so maybe we'll recap. Beginning next week, we'll continue into the third category. We'll recap a little bit then, and then we will take it from there. And so tomorrow, just so you recall, tomorrow's a normal day of Shir, but we had started last week. Is there any more Mar Makomos tomorrow? I don't know where everyone's holding it. I could add more, but if I'm still working on this, then you'll keep that. We were talking, if you recall, we just had introduced the topic of Bezdin for a Get, which is a little bit of a tangent on our daf, but an important tangent with many practical implications. So we'll give a little bit of attention to what Rashi does or does not say and the surrounding discussion about Bezdin for a Get. Okay, Yashikah. Ashri, Yashir, Bezach, Jalifa, Selah, Yashikah.